Hi, this is Barry Listen, Inform, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. First, there was the pitcher ERA and batting average. Then Bill James revolutionized baseball statistics with his historical abstracts. Now, with the publication of Moneyball by Michael Lewis and the subsequent movie starring Brad Pitt, the world of professional sports is clued into the value of quantitative methods in sports. In today's segment, we talk to Michael Fry of the University of Cincinnati and Jeffrey W. Ullman of the University of Iowa. Together, they've edited a two-part special issue of the Inform's journal Interfaces dedicated to analytics and sports. Professor Fry, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry. Glad to be here.
Dr. Ullman, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, why do you think Moneyball captured the imagination of so many people in a way that exceeded even the excitement that came about when Bill James first published his historical abstracts? Dr. Fry, perhaps we'll try you first.
Sure. I think one thing to keep in mind is that Michael Lewis, who wrote the book Moneyball, is a great storyteller, and so he made a very compelling story about the Oakland A's and how they overcame the adversity, and it kind of fits into the typical, what we like to read about and learn about is someone who's an underdog overcoming kind of odds that were stacked against them. They had to make do with a very small payroll and had to compete against much larger clubs. And the movie, having Brad Pitt helps, sell it. And it really kind of just drew on this whole thing of an analytics movement that's happening across all industries, but it combined with a very good story told by Michael Lewis and then the people who developed the movie.
You mentioned industry, and one of the things that you mentioned in your introduction to this series is how large an industry sports is, I guess, both in America and throughout the world. Can you give us a little sense of how large it is from the business perspective, not just from the fan perspective?
Sure. It is a good point. There's actually one of the papers in one of our issues talks about, depending on how you measure things, the sports industry is about twice the size of the automotive industry, and pretty much by any measure, sports industry overall is one of the top 10 industries in the world. So, even just taking out the fact that it's something people like to talk about and is kind of easily conveyed, it's a huge industry. And so if analytics can have an impact on that industry, it's really something that is substantive.
I guess if analytics can improve the way cars are made, which it does, it can also improve the business side of sports.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have lots of papers dealing with inventory and service systems and manufacturing, but sports is a lot of the same things we use, at least to model those industries, apply to sports. And for a lot of people, honestly, it's a little more attractive to talk about.
From all the hoopla, you'd think that Billy Beane was the only one who had thought of using math modeling in sports. But from what one of the authors, Jay Coleman, writes about the players and figurative players in sports analytics research, there's an enormous amount written about sports and math modeling. And Dr. Ullman, maybe you could give us a sense of the scope of research in sports analytics and whether this is just focusing on baseball, as many might think, and whether it's just the phenomenon in the U.S.
Baseball, since it was a sequence of discrete events, it naturally lends itself to analysis. You can break down an event in baseball. Usually it's only going to involve a handful of players, so it's much easier to determine the effect. John Henry, who's the owner of the Red Sox, he is quoted by saying it's much easier to determine what goes into a home run than into a goal in soccer. So it was natural as early as the 1950s for mathematically inclined individuals to try to associate values to events in baseball. Since the problem in the early years, though, is that these individuals are typically disconnected from the people in baseball industry making the decisions. And so it wasn't until the era of Billy Beane, who's the most, the romanticized individual, to really making use of this information and trying to improve decision-making in this manner. Recently, though, the increase in technology, the data tracking technology, has provided some, I guess, hope for applying analytics or more informed analysis on more of these fluid sports such as soccer, and basketball, and American football. And so where you point, where you know where the ball is going to be at all points of time, and even in baseball where lots of analysis has been done, they now can talk about, well, how hard was the ball hit, and you can break down the field into different sectors and say, well, given the ball was hit a certain way, what was the chance it should have been caught in terms of fielding prowess? And in basketball, we can determine where the ball is at all times and how far players have run and their positions relative to the ball, as well as in football. There's been methods of trying to quantify hustle by determining how far a player is from the football at the conclusion of a play.
So even an informal expression like hustle, as you say, is something that can be conceptualized and measured and analyzed.
That's the goal. So you have these coaches who are watching hours and hours of tape, and that's never probably going to go away from the game. But the idea is that if there's things that can be essentially automated or analysis that can be done by algorithms, then the people that can provide value to the sport can spend their time more efficiently.
The papers in your special issue touch on several different sports and end with an entire volume devoted to scheduling sports leagues. Maybe we could look at highlights from the two issues. How does one Major League Baseball team use analytics and operations research to improve the way it looks at draft picks?
Sure. So, you know, sports drafts is something that both Jeff and I have a particular interest in because we've done work in this area as well. And the paper in the special issue by Noah Strive, Steve Young, and Joel Sokol looks at how one particular Major League Baseball team was able to use OR methods to improve their approach to scouting. And one of the difficulties that you face in kind of player evaluation in baseball and all sports is that generally what happens is scouts are sent out on the road to look at a player and evaluate the player. And, you know, if you read the book Moneyball or saw the movie, you even see this come up where the scouts kind of fall in love with a particular player because they look good. And Billy Beane has a great line about, you know, we're not trying to sell jeans, we're trying to win baseball games. And so what often happens is a scout kind of falls in love with one particular player, and that's kind of all they can see. And so what the authors of this paper in the special issue do is they show how if you use multiple scouts' inputs on a player and combine that with some evaluation and then put it into an optimization model, you can basically try to minimize disagreements between the scouts. They actually pull from a voting theory where you do preference voting. And what it shows is that you can kind of remove some of these inherent biases from the scouts and actually get something that's in aggregate much more accurate. And it's something that I think, you know, it's been applied, as they say, in the Major League Baseball, but I think there's still a lot more that could be done both in baseball and other sports and improving both player evaluation and then how those evaluations are used in a drafting process.
And looking at other industries, there is something called work analytics, looking at human resources at the workplace. So this is a little bit akin to that?
Yeah, maybe somewhat. It's in some ways, you know, a draft is kind of a perfect example of many of the things we talk about in operations research. It's a very sequential decision combined with something that's very noisy when you're trying to evaluate players and evaluate how they're going to progress through their careers. So there is things in HR that look at similar types of models that can be applied here.
This is Barry List, and you're listening to the Informs podcast, Science of Better. Today's guests are Michael Fry and Jeffrey Ullman, who are discussing analytics and sports. Let's turn to hockey. One of these papers in your special issue classifies different players and their contributions, looking in particular at goalies and defensive players. What do we learn from these methods? Professor Ullman, can you address that?
Yes, there was a paper in the special issue by Chan Cho and Abadi that uses a clustering algorithm that uses this to classify the value of the hockey players based on their different attributes. And then once they have this clustering, they use it in a regression model that determine kind of the contribution of these player types. And one of the surprising observations that they determined that goalies had the greatest effect on the team's performance. I guess another way of saying this would be that an outstanding goalie is much more valuable than a forward or a defenseman of the same outstanding quality. And so I guess some real-world testimony to this perhaps may be the last Stanley Cup and the goalie for the LA Kings. The analysis that showed that the salaries in the NHL are efficient in terms of if you adjust the player contribution by the cost of player, it looks pretty much even. And so,
which is something to say to fans who are often critical about the high salaries paid to professionals in sports.
Right. Well, I guess you could argue from an economical standpoint that if they wouldn't be getting paid those salaries if somebody wasn't making the money to pay them.
Golf is also lending itself to analytics. For example, two authors look at the FedEx Cup playoff series and suggest ways to improve and redesign the series. What did they do here?
Yes, this is a paper by Hall and Potts where they look at how the PGA Tour might redesign the FedEx Cup, and in particular the competition known as the Tour Championship. And so the idea behind the FedEx Cup and the Tour Championship was the PGA wanted to have a season-long competition between the golfers, and that then this would culminate in something known as the Tour Championship, which would kind of be like the Super Bowl of golf. So you'd have the best golfers competing in each other end of the season, big money, $10 million at stake for the winner. The problem was that the way that this was originally designed, players earned points through the season. And basically what could happen is that by the time the Tour Championship rolled around, so this thing that was supposed to be the Super Bowl, one golfer may have gotten so many points that they could basically, they had already won, and there wasn't much of a competition. This actually happened a few years ago with Vijay Singh, where he had basically clinched before the Tour even took place. So what Hall and Potts show is they come up with a different way of doing this using what's called strongly seeded. So what you did in the season does matter, but then you're seeded into a match play event at the end of the season that would kind of guarantee a competitive event where everybody would have a chance of winning, but those who had done best in the season would have some advantage. And so the Tour, PGA Tour, has actually redone how they do the FedEx Cup and the Tour Championship. They haven't completely adopted what Hall and Potts proposed as a match play event, but they have kind of changed some things to try and make this a more exciting end to the season and something that they'll probably still be playing around with the next couple of years.
And baseball, a player can be rated by different things he does, like hitting and fielding. In golf, it seems there's now an effort to quantify golfers' ability, not just based on one single golf score, how much under par, over par you are, but on individual things like teeing and putting. What's the research that's taken place in this area?
Yeah, so golf, this is one example of how advances in technology or data collection has facilitated more analysis. The PGA Tour has a system called ShotLink where it logs every shot by every player and where that shot began and where it ended. And so Mark Brody took this information, which included over 9 million golf shots over 8 years, to identify which facets of a golfer's game contribute or, on the flip side, hinder his or her overall success. And so based on this, Brody created a new golf statistic called the strokes gained, which measures the effectiveness of each golf shot. And if you break this strokes gained break that out by based on the starting locations, whether it's from the tee, the rough, the fairway, the green, you could actually determine where a golfer and quantify how much better a golfer is better than the average from those locations. And it turns out that the best golfers differentiate themselves according to their long game, which is flies a little bit in the face of the common adage, which is drive for show and putt for dough. What Mark Brody showed is that the best golfers typically are at the top because of their long games.
So even though putting requires fine motor skills, so to speak, teeing off, the first thing that you do has enormous impact.
Right. Basically, the idea is that it's hard to hit a 25-foot putt, So it's the key is, like, you know, getting within 15 feet of the cup, and the faster you can get there, the better. And that's what's been shown. So Tiger Woods, during his peak, or at least to current day, is 2003 to 2010, he was 3.2 strokes better per round than his peers, and 2.08 of those strokes came from his long game versus the other portions of the game. And so it's been bared out quantitatively now where golfers, you know, are better or worse than their peers.
And, of course, based on what you were just saying, you can also analyze better how an individual player has done over the course of his career, as Tiger Woods, for example.
Exactly, yeah.
This is The Science of Better with Barry List. We're discussing sports analytics with Michael Fry of the University of Cincinnati and Jeffrey Ullman of the University of Iowa. The paper on motorcycle racing in the first volume is pretty technical automotive stuff, but perhaps you could give us a quick overview of how optimization can be used in that particular sport.
Sure. This was an application that neither I nor Jeff were very familiar with before receiving the paper, but when you look at the work that the authors did, it turns out that motorcycle racing and racing in general is kind of a perfect setting for applying a lot of OR methods. So this particular paper looked at motorcycle Grand Prix racing. And so what happens is that in these races, the teams have to configure the gearbox, the transmission of the motorcycles for each race. And there's a huge number of combination of different gear sizes that they could put into this gearbox. And what happens in Grand Prix racing is that the races change at each location, and the racetrack could be very, very different from week to week. So 1 week, the track could have lots of tight, twisty turns. The next week could have long straightaways. And so you want a different gearbox combination to give you different RPMs, different accelerations into the turns and straightaways. And so when they go into a race, what they'll do is they'll have their riders do a couple of test laps and kind of see. You can basically calculate using engineering what the maximum RPMs you want when you want to be in what they call a power band, so that you can kind of have the maximum acceleration, maximum RPMs. And then they can put all this information into an IP, into an integer program, that'll actually say, okay, for this racetrack, this type of racer, here's the gearbox assembly we want. And by doing this in an integer program, they can solve these extremely quickly, because you have to do a very quick turnaround to get this gearbox ready. And what they did is basically they were able, this team Aspar, who implemented this, were able to shave several seconds off of each lap on a track, which was the difference between winning and not even finishing in the top five. So it was actually a very nice application of traditional operations research methods.
And, of course, when you're dealing with just a few seconds, but which represents winning or losing, that becomes critical.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this, you know, a couple of seconds doesn't sound like a lot, but the top teams here, that's what separates winners from losers. So it actually is a pretty sizable advantage.
One of the surprises of my career as a young freelance writer was getting an assignment with a bank that sponsored Major League Baseball and realizing that sports is more than the pleasure of watching your favorite team. How does a paper in this collection on fans and marketing look at that side of the business of sports?
Yeah, so the special issue of Interfaces includes a paper that's somewhat outside maybe the typical OR application, but we felt it was very novel and deserved to be included because the topic of fan avidity hasn't really been thoroughly examined in the marketing literature. And so DeSarvo and Madrigal used survey data from college students to determine how students manifest their avidity for college football. And in this process, they developed a tailored marketing model, and it identified four segments. And the four segments they identified were diehard actives, which were students that really expressed team loyalty and were looking to be directly active with the sport rather than just observing it. So they would do things like help clean the stadium, tutor players, and so forth. Then, of course, there was the students that were coined anti-athletic, where they were not as engaged, but just as being a student in a university where college football was prominent, they were informed in passing. And so they were, it wasn't like they were oblivious, but they weren't as engaged. And then there's the social butterflies where they view the games as social events, and they'd attend pep rallies and didn't really necessarily follow the sport per se, but they were very involved in the school spirit and the social aspects. And then the fourth segment was the young belongers, and these were the group that was actually the, and from a revenue perspective, they purchased the most merchandise and memorabilia, and they viewed sports as fun. They were had a lot of school spirit. And so that was the major four segments, and the authors did identify how you'd want to go perhaps addressing each of those segments.
And this is interesting because it's looking at the customers rather than management or the players.
Yes, yeah. So there's organizations like the Cleveland Browns now have a manager of fan avidity where they're trying to engage their fans, and how do you maintain that interest throughout the fan's lifetime, and so research like this is a step in that direction.
We only have time for one more question. There was once a time when people with patience and organization did up whole league schedules on blackboards. Now operations researchers are bringing a sophistication to scheduling. What are our people doing in scheduling, and what kind of problems are they overcoming?
So anyone who's tried to do scheduling on a small scale, whether it's for like a recreational league or for their daughter's swim meets, for instance, when these problems are small, they typically can be managed, but the combinatorial complexity explodes as you get larger leagues and special considerations. And so the second issue of interfaces on analytics and sports focuses solely on sports scheduling problems and how you can use some OR know-how to try to make these problems more a little bit easier to solve. So what impressed me most across these papers was that to the layperson, the mathematical nature of operations research may seem rigid. You know, math seems like where it can't be flexible enough to accommodate any qualitative considerations that may arise. And so in these settings, sports scheduling was often done manually. But each of these papers demonstrate that OR can be successful in these domains and quantify these soft features. And so you have requests from multiple stakeholders, such as television studios, you have teams. In one paper we had student athletes, and in another paper we had parents. And so all these have different requests. Well, each of these papers demonstrated how to formulate these as constraints or express these as objectives, and then through an iterative process actually propose alternative solutions. And so this actually it was tailor-made in some sense for the qualitative. There wasn't just one right answer, but it allowed the problem solver, the league schedulers, to develop a transparent objective process that would incorporate all the requests and generate alternative schedules. And so this allowed the stakeholders to actually see trade-offs. So if they wanted, you know, X, they had to give up Y because of the conflict that it would create. Not everybody could get everything they wanted because of the direct conflicts.
Which is an amazing thing to offer. That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Fry of the University of Cincinnati and Dr. Jeffrey W. Ullman of the University of Iowa. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.